From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Many months into a global pandemic of staggering proportions, we're living in what could be viewed as not just a disaster, but a mega disaster. One that we as a society were ill-prepared for in terms of infrastructure and economy and healthcare and so much more. Disasters such as devastating earthquakes, terrorist attacks, industrial accidents, or nuclear war are so terrifying that our human psyche may be ill-equipped to imagine the scale of the resulting crisis. But in order to be resilient, we must prepare. And joining me to share his guide on how to prepare is Jeffrey Slegamelch, Deputy Director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Earth Institute. He previously worked for the Yale New Haven Health System Center for Emergency Preparedness and Disaster Response and the Boston Public Health Commission. He's written a new book called Rethinking Readiness, a brief guide to 21st century mega disasters. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Thank you for having me. Great to talk with you today.
So what constitutes a mega disaster as opposed to a disaster?
Yeah, so there's a lot of terms we use in disaster science that sort of have fuzzy edges to them, like resilience and things like that. But when I think of mega disasters, I like to think of that as disasters that are of such a scale that they disrupt the very systems that are designed to manage those disasters. They kind of break our disaster response infrastructure. And in this book and in some of the catastrophes we've seen throughout history, there are mega disasters of an even greater scale that not only sort of break those response systems, but also alter the trajectory of human history.
So I imagine the recent explosion in Beirut, Lebanon might qualify as a mega disaster. The grain silo devastated. There's no sense of where, how people are going to get fed, where 300,000 displaced people are going to live.
Absolutely. And you also see the resignation of a government as a result of this and really repercussions not only throughout the country, but throughout the region to an extent that we're not even entirely sure of yet in these early days after the explosion. So certainly a disaster of very significant proportions and one that, you know, of course, our hearts are with those affected by this and the true damage remains to be seen.
And then you have our COVID-19 pandemic that we're living through, which seems to be a much more slow-moving disaster, but a disaster nonetheless. It's expected that 200,000 Americans will have died from the disease before the end of the year. So it's not something that just broke it like a massive explosion, but a slow-moving disaster where we saw what was coming and appeared completely unprepared, at least in this country, to handle it.
Yeah, and with pandemics like COVID-19, although COVID-19 itself was a surprise, the idea of a pandemic affecting the United States at this scale was not a surprise to anyone. And in fact, periodically throughout history, this is one of those, you know, age-old mega disasters that we see time and time again throughout the course of history. You know, a lot of eyes were on influenza because we tend to see influenza pandemics. Of course, there's the plague of the Middle Ages, among many, many other pandemics. And it's certainly, unfortunately, having an effect that's far greater than perhaps it needed to be given the ability to see these things coming.
And therefore, your first chapter is entitled Bio Threats, right?
Yeah, and looks at both pandemics and these kind of naturally occurring, although that's probably a little bit of a misnomer because although it's a natural disease outbreak, not an act of bioterrorism or antibiotic resistance or something like that, which we also talk about in the book, but it's it is emerging, jumping from, you know, animal populations to people due to encroachment in these different ecosystems and then spreading very quickly through a much more interconnected world. So while the initial origin is from this kind of natural hazard, there's really very little that's natural about the spread and impact of the disease once it makes that jump to people and even before.
So bio threats like deadly disease of the kind that we are grappling with today are, I imagine, as devastating as our societies are ill-prepared to meet them.
Yeah, and so with each of the disasters that we sort of frame out in these scenarios that I look at in the book is really looking at how human activity is contributing to both the overarching threat and the underlying vulnerabilities. So what you describe is exactly correct, right? We are increasing this threat by, living and encroaching on these delicate ecosystems, these biodiverse areas, by having a more and more interconnected world. And we're also increasing our vulnerability by not adequately funding our early detection and public health response systems. And, you know, we're seeing this in shortages of personal protective equipment and ventilators because of the way we create global kind of just-in-time supply chains. And so these are all elements on where the way that we're developing society is contributing not only to the threat of something bad happening, but also our vulnerability and the level of damage that that does to us while we attempt to respond to it.
And therefore, we can see in almost as a grand experiment why some countries in the world have managed to meet this crisis better than other countries, that even faced with the same threat, whether it was because their healthcare systems were better capable of meeting the disaster or that existing health conditions were not as bad as they are in the U.S., we see countries that have managed to meet the crisis with much more readiness, say Germany or New Zealand or Taiwan, than countries like the US, the UK, Brazil, etc., right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of different dynamics here. And one of those, of course, is the political dynamics. Now, there are some underlying cultural reasons. There was a great kind of roundup of behavioral science in Nature a couple of weeks ago, looking at how more collective societies are more likely to adopt sacrifices for the benefit of the community, more individualistic societies. Those are some headwinds in terms of implementing this. But we're also absolutely seeing some political headwinds where we're seeing inconsistency in messaging coming from different government agencies and government offices, and in particularly from the administration in the United States. We're also seeing less leveraging of available federal policies and programs that could be more useful and better utilized to help manage and distribute across different states, rather than have states competing for personal protective equipment and ventilators and life-saving equipment like that, as well as just kind of a bipartisan failure over the last several decades to invest properly in public health systems and healthcare systems and to create a national capacity to respond to pandemics. There was a patchwork of teams cobbled together by different administrations in the past, but that sort of cohesive, comprehensive approach to pandemic planning and pandemic response still eludes us even to this day.
I mean, we basically had decades of defunding of social safety nets, of the kinds of programs that would have made the U.S. a much more resilient society. Is COVID-19 a preview of our unpreparedness or lack of preparedness around climate change, or just the topic of your second chapter? Many of us thought that the disaster we would be living through would be first and foremost climate change, because of course, unlike the federal government, who was briefed on the fact that a pandemic can arise any moment, most ordinary people weren't thinking about a disease, but we were thinking about climate change.
Yeah, and I would actually say that we were experiencing the impacts of climate change in its earlier stages before COVID-19 and during COVID-19. We're seeing the increased wildfires out west. We're seeing different dynamics in terms of extreme weather events, hurricanes carrying more water, greater wind speed, this potentially adding additional destabilization to parts of the world. These are things that are happening now and were happening even before COVID-19. The acceleration of that is a little bit slower and a little bit longer tailed than that of the COVID-19 pandemic. But you're absolutely right. I mean, these are all disasters. And while, the book introduces these different scenarios as a way to sort of contextualize, it's really these cross-cutting issues. It's things like having these comprehensive views, looking at how development affects these threats and vulnerabilities, managing uncertainty, dealing with complex scientific information. It's not, you can't distill that down into a tweet or a bumper sticker for what should be done. It's more complex than that. But I also just want to touch on, you mentioned a lot of these underlying issues in terms of resilience for a society. And I think that's a really important point, because when we talk about building resilience and building preparedness, it's not just about having duct tape and a week's worth of food and water or something like that. It's about looking at these social inequalities within our society. Who has access to healthcare and who doesn't? Who are the essential workers who have to go to work? Who are the people who can afford to stay home because they're in a job that affords them that, or they have sick leave and things like that? All of these things contribute. They set the table to how the disasters play out. And too often, and in climate change and with COVID-19, we're seeing it disproportionately affect communities of color, people of lower socioeconomic status, and widening these inequalities. And it's a very different pandemic depending on where you sit in this country and on this planet.
And then you can have other unexpected disasters like what you deem critical infrastructure failure, a train getting derailed, a dam bursting. I point out Flint, Michigan's water crisis as one example. These seem to be more directly the failure of government preparedness.
Yeah, and this is sort of a growing threat that we have as well, too. You know, it's really great to cut ribbons and debut new highways, and there's nothing really politically, salient about maintaining a highway or maintaining an infrastructure. And here we have with some of the examples talked about in the book, the Oroville Dam in California, where you had more than 200,000 people evacuated overnight. Thankfully, the dam did not fail, but if it did fail, you would have 200,000 people, internally displaced refugees within the United States, who could not return home if that dam had failed. In Flint, Michigan, you had calls for evacuating the city of Flint if children couldn't be protected. This chronic exposure of an entire population to a contaminant that's a result of a failure of infrastructure. So I think too that failed infrastructure is about more than inconvenient power outages and potholes in the road, but there are actually looming mega disasters creating the potential for the kind of response domestically that we previously, in the U.S. at least, have really only thought about in terms of international humanitarian assistance.
We recently passed the 75th anniversaries of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings, the atomic bombings, nuclear conflict, which is something that seems abstract because we haven't had it in many decades, is still a very real threat, is it not, particularly given that nuclear weapons remain, they exist, they're proliferating. We don't talk about them very much. We talked about them briefly during the Obama administration. There was an appetite to start to draw down the weaponry that seems to have taken a complete backseat. And it is still a very real thing, even though we may not think about it, the prospect of a nuclear war.
Yeah, absolutely. And as long as there are nuclear weapons in this world, there's the potential for their use. And in many ways, the potential for their use has increased rather than diminished since the end of the Cold War. But the threat that we're facing has also changed. Instead of this global posturing of superpowers with global killing arsenals pointed at each other, it really made preparedness for something like this irrelevant. If there was a war between the Soviet Union and the United States, that's pretty much game over for everybody on the planet. Now, when we're talking about rogue nations, the prospect of nuclear terrorism and the kind of weapons that are in the hands more likely to be used, we start to get to these smaller kind of kiloton weapons that would cause a lot of damage, but also with the right kind of preparedness, it could be the difference of hundreds of thousands of lives for folks getting out of the way of the fallout, doing the right kind of sheltering and then evacuation as a result of this. So it's a very different threat, although it still persists to this day. But it's a very, very difficult one. How do you have a conversation? How does a mayor or a governor have a conversation with its constituents about how to deal with a modern nuclear threat? It's just something that is either too complicated to deal with or just not the top concern on folks' minds, but it's something we shouldn't forget. For sure.
Right. It seems to be just an issue of political will. A nuclear weapons, a nuclear war, how to prevent it is not a very complicated thing. You want to prevent nuclear war, you get rid of nuclear weapons. And of course, it's just the reluctance of political leaders to want to do that. And the threat to societies doesn't seem to be a concern for those who have their finger close to the button. It's just really remarkable.
Yeah, and strategically, it's such a powerful situation to be in. I've heard the expression in the past, right, that for many nations, the ideal number of nuclear states is one, right? Mm-hmm. And whenever you're not sure, you have to have that deterrent, to have that threat. Unfortunately, we've painted ourselves in this corner where strategically, it's very difficult to remove that. But on the flip side, it creates this ever-present threat. And the less we pay attention to the accessibility of nuclear materials and the accessibility of nuclear weapons, the more likely it is that they're going to get in the hands of someone who is maybe less hesitant in using them, or that we might catch ourselves on a bad day during a bad time doing something that we shouldn't. So absolutely agree.
Let's talk about cyber threats, which you also address in your book. What could cyber threats actually look like? Our world today is very much dependent on digital technologies, which are convenient and can be, to an extent, fail-safe, but also incredibly vulnerable.
Yeah, you know, there are kind of these doomsday scenarios from the Hollywood perspective of shutting down the grid for years and permanently, you know, shutting things down. And these kinds of things are actually a little less plausible given the number of manual overrides. What really makes cybersecurity so pervasive and such a dynamic threat is that well, there's a lot of reasons, but one in particular that I found interesting in researching for the book is how it can be used as a complement to nation states and their strategic forces and their strategic approaches. Instead of having to have a fight on a battlefield, you can do something much more covert. So we'll give the example of the 2016 election, where there was a lot of evidence of Russian interference and attempts to go in there and do things like change the roles of folks showing up for an election. Now, because of the way that elections are run and compartmented in this country, it's not really likely that they're going to be able to that anyone's going to be able to change the result of a national election by hacking into a few voting machines. But if you start changing people's voter rolls and they show up to cast their vote and they're not on the list, and on top of that, you have a lot of heated rhetoric about how there's a lot of voter fraud and how your vote doesn't count, regardless of whether there's any evidence for that, in which case, and it's worth saying there is no evidence for widespread voter fraud, even though that's being projected. What that does is that starts to undermine democracy itself in this country. And that's much more insidious and much more pervasive. So some of the scenarios talked about in the book do talk about sort of the complexity of attacks, against the nuclear facility in Iran, against the Ukrainian power grid, as well as some physical damage that can be caused by overriding certain safety systems in generators and other pieces with moving parts. But really this complement, this component of kind of asymmetrical warfare for nation states opens up a whole new avenue in terms of vulnerability that I don't think is fully understood. And states and individuals and companies are on the front lines of this. So it's not a national problem. It's really the localities are on the front lines of a lot of this. And I'm not sure that we're adequately prepared to deal with an assault at that level and that magnitude.
Jeff, I'm wondering whether we as humans are equipped psychologically to imagine these disasters in order to be really ready for them. I mean, I know, for example, every time we've covered the issue of climate change has been historically an issue that has felt so big that people have naturally, you know, really felt pessimistic about it. It's such a big issue. Our brains seem to have not evolved to a place where we can grasp the scale of disaster that can result. But in order to be resilient, in order to be prepared, we do have to imagine disasters beyond the scope of our own imagining, right?
Yeah, as well as to, you know, identify how we fit in with that. And I think, you know, with the book and probably everything that I've talked about up till now, there's probably some folks really into this who are, you know, really excited to read it. And a lot of other folks saying, oh, I've got so much stuff on my mind already. I don't need all this additional stuff on top of it. What can I do about nuclear war? What can I do about cybersecurity? And that's where the book sort of takes a turn more towards how do we reframe our thinking for these 21st century disasters. It's not about finding a precise solution. It's no longer about finding the right combination of words or tweet to resolve everyone's concerns. It's about managing uncertainty. And I think everyone is developing a lot of expertise in that right now with COVID-19, right? Everything from schools in the fall to going back to work to, you know, what's the transmission rate going to be tomorrow? We're dealing with a lot of uncertainty. And how do you create options? How do you create new frameworks that instead of trying to artificially pretend that uncertainty is not there, but actually embrace it. And instead of trying to create a solution, to create options that can be laid out as more information is available. And then integrating that into how we ourselves interact with civil society, as well as with our communities and with our families. One of the best things we can do is build social cohesion with our neighbors. Have a barbecue, check in on that person next to you. Socially distancing, of course, you know, do it outside, 6 feet apart. But the
But those rely on the sort of personal actions. I mean, don't we also need broader governmental policy change? We have this society that here in the United States deeply looks down upon, social safety net, broad policies that actually help ordinary people. And we have rich, a small handful of people getting rich at the expense of the rest of us. capitalism seems to be a hindrance to resiliency. There also seems to me to be a requirement that people understand and agree that science is important. I mean, it seems ludicrous to even say that these days, considering how much we depend on science, scientific discovery, scientific technology, but there's so much skepticism these days. Are you worried that that impacts our resiliency and preparedness?
So I haven't looked directly at this data, but I've been told about some data that actually there's more trust in science than there ever has been in the past. But at the same time, the distrust, it's much more polarized. So the strong distrust is much more polarized. So the experience is, it seems that there's less and less trust in science. So it creates a very interesting dynamic. And I think in practical terms, which I agree with you, you're sort of at this point where some people are adhering to where the science is pointing us and others are just hard and fast denying it, and also having that perspective amplified by certain actors and sometimes even elected officials and folks in positions of power. But I have mixed feelings. On the one hand, I think that, science is only going to get us so far. And a lot of times, science doesn't give us the certainty that we want. It points us in a certain direction, and then decisions need to be made. So for an example with COVID-19, there's no precise science on what effect masks have on transmission. It's the general consensus is that it reduces it, but it needs to be layered with additional, social distancing and things like that as well too. With climate change, right, the front on the war on climate change is about the science, the legitimacy of the science. And there are certainly some crackpots out there sort of cherry picking evidence one way or another. But I really think that the widespread concern is that you have these industries where it's an existential threat, right? Where you're working in a global environment where, there are others who are not following the same rules, and it's cheaper for them not to follow the same rules. Only instead of addressing the issue and addressing the transition that needs to occur for these companies, that they don't have a place in a warming world, the argument's been shifted to the science. And so that's where the argument is. That's where the fight is happening right now. But I don't think that it's really about getting people to believe in the science. I think they're grasping at an argument to try and survive in a world that doesn't have a place for them anymore.
Well, Jeff, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Jeff Slegomelch, Deputy Director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Earth Institute. And we have been talking about his new book called Rethinking Readiness, A Brief Guide to 21st Century Mega Disasters. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.